This is a Kingsley Napoli podcast on lasting powers of attorney. I'm Jim Saw, partner in the private client department, with my partner Anita Gill. Anita, I think everyone accepts that as we're living longer, there's a high probability that we'll lose mental capacity to deal with our finances at some stage.
Yes, indeed, Jim. And that's why the government introduced the enduring power of attorney, which has now been replaced by a lasting power of attorney. This enables us to appoint people to look after our affairs if we lose capacity.
And I guess if we don't appoint someone, there's still the process by which someone close to us can apply to the court to be appointed as a deputy for our financial affairs?
And that is correct. The deputyship process hasn't changed other than the previous deputies used to be called receivers. But that does take time and it costs money. Plus, there is the need to produce an annual statement to the court and the formalities that involves.
I guess in some ways a report to the court every year could be a good thing. I mean, it means that the deputy's actions are regularly reviewed.
Absolutely, Jim. The actions of people who are appointed a deputy are scrutinised by the court by a body called the Office of Public Guardian. However, those under a lasting power of attorney are not, unless, of course, there is a complaint to the Office of Public Guardian. For me, really, the key decision when making a lasting power of attorney is not the wording of the form, but ensuring you pick the right people to be your attorney or attorneys.
I mean, I understand that most financial abuse of elderly persons is carried out by their own children. So should we really be appointing our children as our attorneys?
I think so, for the most part, especially if you appoint your children jointly and severally, so they can sort of keep an eye on each other's actions, I guess.
So jointly and severally, but not jointly.
That's correct. So if you appoint a joint attorney, they have all to take a part in every decision, and that can be cumbersome. Especially if one of them is ill or dies, then the whole power is effectively nullified, if you like. It's better to appoint jointly and severally so that each has the power to act independently of the other as necessary, but it is subject to the scrutiny of the other attorney.
I think I agree with you there. I mean, I do sometimes see a joint and several power where the attorneys have to act jointly in some circumstances, like, for example, selling the donor's house?
Yes, that is in fact very common. You can put restrictions on your lasting power of attorney, but the attorneys must in any event always act in the best interest of the person who has granted them that power. You know, it might be their father or mother. Generally, it should be okay for them to have a general sort of joint and several power. And the legislation is pretty clear on what they can and can't do, as is case law.
Such as?
So, for example, one always has to act in the best interest of the person who gave them the power, and therefore there are certain things they definitely cannot do.
I think you're thinking about making gifts, especially to themselves.
Yes, exactly. You can't help yourself to your mum's money. As you wish, you can spend your mother's money on your usual sort of Christmas gifts, birthday gifts, and keep making any regular payments to charity if that's what your parent did. But you cannot make substantial gifts, however sensible, even if it is for tax planning purposes. You do need the court's permission in situations like that, and the court will not just look at things in isolation. They will have an overall look at the best interests for the person who granted the power of attorney.
So if you're frustrated in the inheritance tax planning process by not being able to make gifts, I'm assuming you can make inheritance tax effective investments. For example, investing in shares listed on the alternative investment market?
Yes, you do have to take proper advice though, Jim, and make sure that that investment is in the best interest of the person who's granted the power, not simply just to save tax on what you might inherit. Can I ask you something, Jim? Do you have a lasting power of attorney yourself?
I do indeed. I mean, I'm 59 now, and I always advise my clients that they should think about getting a lasting power in place from their mid-50s onward. My wife has one, and so do my late mother. I have to say, though, my sisters and I didn't really have to rely on my mother's power of attorney very much, because what we did is she started to lose capacity. We took the opportunity to get her financial affairs on an even keel, so they practically ran themselves. We got standing orders and direct debit set up to pay the nursing home fees and so on.
That's very good planning, Jim. Can I ask you one more question? Do you have a separate health and welfare power of attorney?
No, I don't, as it happens. If I'm honest, I don't really worry about getting into a position where I'm unable to make healthcare decisions for myself. Perhaps I'm a bit of a coward or superstitious. It's just something I don't want to think about.
I think I might agree with you. A lasting power of attorney is certainly a must for all of us sooner or later, although a healthcare power does allow you to appoint someone who you know is aware of your views on medical issues and, how should I put it, matters of life and death, rather than leaving the decision-making process to unknown doctors. The form does also contain a very vital question as to whether or not you or your attorneys are empowered to authorise or refuse life-sustaining treatment.
Yeah, I guess that's many people's biggest fear, that they'd be artificially kept alive in a vegetative state with no quality of life.
I agree.
In my experience, though, it's the right of attorneys to make accommodation decisions that bothers people most. So many old people fear that their attorneys have the ability to put them into a home.
That's right, but really in practice, that right only kicks in when you've lost mental capacity and can't make your own decisions. There are various statutory safeguards in place called deprivation of liberty. So depending on your level of capacity, you are consulted.
But even with those safeguards, I guess if you really are worried about an attorney having power to put you into a home against your will, the answer is you just don't make a health and welfare power of attorney.
I agree, it really is a matter of personal choice, whereas with a financial power, getting one in place before it's too late is pretty much a must-do.
I'm not sure of the exact statistics, but I'm guessing it's about 50-50 between those people who create their own lasting powers of attorney using the forms available online and those who choose to employ a solicitor.
That sounds about right. The government is encouraging people to do it themselves, which is why they developed the online system. And it's perceived to be a fairly straightforward process, and I'm, of course, in favour of all that. However, the advantage of using a solicitor is, whilst that may cost you money, there is confidence that the process will be handled properly. You can be assured of a useful conversation and advice on your options and things to consider whilst making that decisions. And of course, the solicitor can act as your certificate provider.
Yeah, that reminds me of the safeguards inherent in the lasting power of attorney process. First of all, you need that certificate provider who countersigns to confirm that the person creating the power both understands its effect and is comfortable appointing the chosen attorneys.
That's correct. And secondly, that power needs to be registered with the court. So this means that if there is a complaint or there's some issue over the attorney's actions, then the court, i.e. the public guardian, has all the details on file to enable it to react pretty promptly if any issues arise.
And I understand that the number of complaints is continually rising.
That's certainly the case. Last year, for 2017-18, I think the complaints had gone up from 272 to 465, which is an increase of about 71%.
Yes, I saw those figures as well, though I'm guessing that the increase reflects, in some part, the fact that more and more powers of attorney are actually being created.
Absolutely, that's certainly the case. But I think there's also a growing awareness of financial abuse of the elderly. People are alert to warning signs and ready to bring their concerns to the Office of Public Guardian or to the police or to adult safeguarding protection teams within the local authority.
And for the most part, who makes these complaints? Is it members of the family?
Very often, yes, siblings do seem to get a perverse pleasure of reporting their brother or sister for abuse of their positions as attorney. But it might also be a carer, the milkman, a concerned neighbour, family, friends.
Given that the financial abuse is so often perpetrated by one of an elderly person's own children, is there something to be said for appointing a professional attorney like a solicitor?
Sometimes, yes, despite the extra cost. Sometimes there's just no one suitable in the family or friend circle who's willing or able to act, and the families can often be quite toxic when it comes to these issues, which is the buzzword, I guess.
So, putting to one side the doom, the gloom, and the financial abuse, do you still think that lasting powers of attorney are a good idea?
Yes, I do, Jim. The government has properly responded to a very real national need in light of an ageing population, which in comparative terms is possibly the country's wealthiest ever. Letting people who will look after their finances when they lose capacity, rather than relying on someone to take the initiative, maybe kickstart the deputyship process, does give people a degree of control beyond their loss of capacity. Yes, of course, there is abuse in a small number of cases. The law will not be able to stamp out greed, sibling rivalry, but there are safeguards in place. And if you couple this with an increased public awareness and willingness to report financial abuse, you do have a system that's working pretty well.
Thanks, Anita. I'm with you on that. Like you, I'm a very strong advocate of the lasting power of attorney. And for those listeners who want more information, there are a number of blogs on our website dealing with issues surrounding lasting powers of attorney and mental capacity generally. Thank you for listening.